From the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, this is Veterans Radio. And now, here's your host, Dale Fromberry.
And good morning, America, and welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry, and I am pleased and honored to be your host today. Our technical director is Nina, and Nina is running our board for us. And it's just the two of us here today, so we're pretty excited about the program that's coming up. It's going to be Jack Hubbard, who was he's an interesting guy. He was in the Canadian Army, and then he was in the American Army, and then he ended up being a communications officer or an NCO on B-17s, and we're going to talk about his adventures from his memoir and called Patriot's Will. I'm going to bring him on in just a little bit. But I do have a couple of pieces of news that I wanted to give you. Many of you are aware, or maybe you weren't aware, that our partner Gary Lilly was killed in a hit-and-run accident in August of 2011. And I just wanted to kind of give you an update as to what's going on with that particular trial. And, well, it's over, folks. It is over. And Gary's person was sentenced yesterday, and he was sentenced to 19 months to 15 years, and they let him away in handcuffs, and I think it's appropriate. And I'm glad that this is finally over for the family and all of the friends, and that maybe we can, you know, move on a little bit more as we go forward with talking about our friend Gary Lilly. If you'll notice, we always talk about Gary quite a bit here on Veterans Radio because he is the guardian angel that stands and sits over us each weekend to make sure that we tell the truth, tell the stories, and ask the question, what have you done to help a veteran today? So, Gary, people didn't give up. They followed through. And Mr. Kevin Warren has been sentenced to 19 months to 15 years in prison. Whew, boy, that's a long time coming. So we wanted to make sure that occurred. There are a lot of things going on around the country. We want you to check your local newspaper or listen to your radio stations for veterans. There are events coming up here locally. There's a Veterans Valentine's Day program coming up, sponsored by the Ann Arbor VA. We'll have more information on that coming up in the next couple of weeks to talk about that. If you've got a story that you want us to tell, or you've got an event that's coming up that you would like us to promote, we'd be more than happy to help you out. Just give us a call here on the air at 877-573-7825. That's 877-573-7825. We'll get your story on the air if we can. We'll promote your activity, your event, your fundraiser, whatever it happens to be. If you can't get us while we're on the air, you can always contact us at our website, veteransradio.net. Click on Contact Us, give us your little message, and I promise we will try to get back to you. How's that for it? We'll promise to try and get back to you. You know, we're a little bit technologically challenged sometimes. And I'm supposed to point out, yes, thank you. Supposed to point out that Veterans Radio is on Facebook. And you can go there and add yourself as a friend, I guess is what it's called. And we've got some photos up there, and we're going to be adding some more photos to you. I just got a great email just this morning from Joe Brown. And Joe is a civilian contractor way over yonder. He's over in, I think he's in Iraq or Afghanistan. I'm sorry, I can't say that. No, it says he's in Kuwait right now. And he sent us a picture of him in front of his unit. This is his fifth deployment. And he's wearing a Veterans Radio shirt. So this is cool. So we'll try to get that up on our website as soon as we can on Facebook and or Twitter. Yes, we do, folks. We tweet. And it's a little embarrassing when I say that to my friends, but we do that. And so we're trying to get caught up on all of these things. So if you want to join us, you just go to @VeteransRadio for Twitter. And I think it's the same thing for Facebook. Is that right, Nina?
You go to Facebook.com/VeteransRadio.
Thank you. See, we have experts all around us today. So we're very excited about that. I want to get into our story here in just a second. We're going to take a break and then we'll come back with Jack. But I want to tell you, you know, when I just mentioned earlier that, you know, send us an email if you have a story that you want to recommend. Well, we got this email from Marianne Dabinette, and I know that I'm messing that up, but she lives down near Fort Myers, Florida, and she said, you know, I was speaking with a friend today about Veterans Radio, that I enjoy listening to it on Saturday mornings on Ave Maria Radio, our affiliate down there at 98.5 FM. And I said that to my friend Jack that I always think of him while listening to the program because he's a decorated World War II veteran, a major with a very interesting story. In fact, he has written and published a book outlining his service. His name is Jack Hubbard. His book is Patriot's Will, Surviving the Great Depression and World War II Combat. He said he would love to be interviewed on the program, and when I talked to him, it was great. I love talking to these heroes of mine and heroes of all of yours, these World War II generation veterans. He's a very interesting, intelligent man and a wonderful speaker. Well, Jack, you better go thank Marianne for doing that. And so we're going to be coming back in just a moment, talking with Jack Hubbard. In the meantime, you're listening to Veterans Radio. We'll be right back.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
And that was Glenn Miller and his orchestra, and that's Sabotage. And I picked that because in reading Jack Hubbard's book, Patriot's Will, he mentions a lot about different kinds of music in there. So we were searching through the archives and library of our vast collection of World War II music, and unfortunately that was the only one I could find from Glenn Miller. But I wanted to play that for Jack. Joining me now on the air from Florida is Jack Hubbard, a retired United States Air Force major type person, World War II veteran, survivor of the Depression and World War II. And Jack, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Good morning, Dale. How are you?
I am terrific, and thank you very much for being on the program this morning. I can't tell you how much I enjoyed your book.
And I'm just very happy to be on your program, and I certainly do want to thank Marianne for making it possible.
Well, I want you to thank her when you see her again, because
I will.
It's a great story, Jack, and it kind of follows. I should give the whole title of the book. It's called Patriot's Will: Surviving the Great Depression and World War II Combat, and you certainly did a both of those. So let's start off with where were you born, Jack?
I was born in Huntingburg, Indiana.
Okay, and you were born a couple of years ago.
And 1922. Right.
Holy mackerel. You know, it's always fun when I'm talking to gentlemen like you, because my dad graduated high school in 1922, I think. And so it's always, I'm finding out more and more about his generation with each one of you that I get to talk to. So that's, I think my partner Bob Gould told me that's the reason that I do this program, trying to find out who I am. But it's great talking with you. So you're born in Indiana. Tell me a little about growing up during that time period. Your family was unfortunately split up, but your grandfather and your father were fairly successful businessmen.
Yeah, they were. They were very wealthy, and We moved from Huntingburg in 1927 to Spartanburg, South Carolina. And we went to South Carolina mainly because of the availability of white oak trees. They were in the barrel stave business, and they needed the white oak, you know, for their staves. And I was there until I was 13 or 14. My father lost everything, though, during the Depression, and that was really disastrous for him. And he became an alcoholic, and things went from bad to worse.
Well, tell me a little bit about growing up in South Carolina during the 30s.
Oh, that was a wonderful experience. I was a Boy Scout. Just had gone into Scouts when I was 12 years old, and I gave myself to the Lord Jesus Christ, my Savior, when I was 12 years old also, and things were really slow-paced back in those days, and I really did walk a mile to school and back.
Uphill both ways.
My books. A lot of people kid about that, you know, with brown sack, you know, for lunch. And,
mm-hmm. It was a different time.
It was a different time entirely.
And,
yes.
And you describe this really well in your book and talking about what it was like to go to school like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, even though I'm a little bit younger, not quite as young as I used to be, but, you know, we used to walk to school, too, and carry our lunch and so forth. And we, you know, had a deadly fear of our teachers. I don't know if it was our fear of our teachers or fear of our parents if they found out that something had occurred in school. But so you were in South Carolina, but then you, for some reason, you can probably fill us in here, you end up going to California.
Yes, I did. I'll never forget, my father and I left with $5.20 and hitchhiked from Spartanburg to Los Angeles. And then I started selling newspapers at Hollywood and Vine in Hollywood, California. And I went to Hollywood High, and in fact, Judy Garland was in my history class, but she wasn't there very often. She was tutored, of course, for schooling
she
at
was
the
busy.
Studios.
Yeah.
But
she was busy.
Yes, but she was a great gal, just like one of the gang. Had a great personality, just as it came out on the screen.
I should point out to our listeners that the book is Patriot's Will. We're talking with its author, Jack Hubbard. If you've got a question for Jack or a comment, please give us a call here on Veterans Radio at 877-573-7825, and we'll get you on the air and you can talk with Jack. Jack, you ran into a lot of well-known people throughout your lifetime, and we're not going to talk about them all now, but I find that fascinating. It seemed like everywhere you landed, you ran into somebody who was relatively famous.
Yeah, I was very fortunate to run into a lot of celebrities, and part of it, early part of it, was because I was in the British uniform, and when I came home on leave from Canada, of course, the United States was not in the war at the time, it was unique to see someone in a British-type uniform, and people were very generous to me, particularly like when I was in New York. I was a guest at the Tommy Dorsey Band at one of the hotels there, and Frank Sinatra and others I met, and it was just great. It was a wonderful experience.
Well, speaking of being in the Canadian Army, how did you ever end up being in the Canadian Army?
Well, I went to the movies in Hollywood one time and saw on the news. In those days, they had the Movie Tone News, the Pathé News, and mm-hmm. I saw the Germans marching through the Arc de Triomphe in Paris, and the cameras pan the sidewalks, and there's a French gentleman crying, and the tears rolling down his cheeks, and I was a green kid, just turned 18, and I thought, gosh, I can do something for those people. I'm going to join up and fight. So I hitchhiked to Canada and joined up and was trained in Canada in a tank outfit, and then went overseas with them, later on, the States came to war, transferred the American forces.
Well, there are some stories that go along with it. I'm not going to let you skip over it quite this quickly. Mm-hmm. As far as, you know, what was it in the book you mentioned how the being in the Canadian military affected you pretty much for the rest of your life? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, yes. They had very strong discipline, much more so than the U.S. Army, at least my experiences at that time. And the discipline, it was just almost next to the German strong discipline, mm-hmm. iron discipline, they called it. And that stuck with me all my life. And some of the other things, traits that I learned, and some of the people I was associated with and the leadership and that sort of thing. And it just inspired me to go to greater heights if I could, you know. And I knew I was handicapped with a lack of education and so forth, but it all worked out then.
Yeah, well, for our audience, you had dropped out of high school. You didn't finish high school.
That's correct. I only had 2 years of high school formally, and then I got my GED past that after mm-hmm. the war. Then when I became an officer, I started night school after duty, and over a 10-year period, and I got a little over 3 years of college. It was the hard way. Believe me, it was difficult.
I'm sure that it was. Well, okay, so you're in the German or the Canadian Tank Corps,
mm-hmm.
and you end up going over to Britain, and you start your, according to your book, your love affair with London.
Yes, I love London. It's one of the greatest cities in the world, if not the greatest. Yes, it was just, of course, I was at an impressionable age at the time, and consequently, I just loved the pace of life and the attitude of the people. They were very strong to put up with what they did with the bombing. When I was in London, the bombs were dropping quite frequently, almost every night. And these people just went about their way. You know, Churchill was a great leader, and he was the one that kept them going, I'm sure.
Well, throughout your book, you really help us out by putting in a sort of a mini timeline, let us know what's going on historically at the time when you were there, and you talk about Churchill and you give some quotes from a couple of his speeches, you know, especially the one I like is, you know, that there will always be an England.
Yeah.
And, you know, how he was so inspirational. And you ran into some interesting people while you were in London. You met a lot of young women, and of course, being in the military, that's understandable.
Yes, well, I dated a young lady there soon after I got to London. And, by the way, I was there for about a year and a half before I went in the Air Force. Anyway, mm-hmm. during that period of time, I met this young lady who was a daughter of a gentleman who worked at the movie studios. And we really hit it off together, and we started to become very serious. And I was really in love with her, and I think she was with me. And I was trying to see every opportunity I had, and likewise with her. And then one afternoon, I called her home, and there was no answer. And I called later on and several more times, and I couldn't get through. Then I became concerned. I called the telephone company and the military, whoever, I don't remember exactly. And long story short, she and her whole family were killed in a bomb raid.
Wow.
And it was... you know, that really touched me very deeply. That's the first time the war had really affected me personally to that extent.
Well, it certainly is it's a sad story, but probably an all-too-familiar story, especially for the people of England. You mentioned in your book that this generation and the generations right now really don't know or understand or appreciate what you had to go through. And I'm not saying that, you know, that it was tough.
It was tough going, you know. When I think about living in the barracks like we did when I was flying combat, it was pretty grim. I mean, two men, you know, double bunk beds, that sort of thing, and it wasn't warm enough, two little pot stoves at each end of the barracks, and there were 30 or 40 men in the barracks, and it was just miserable. I mean, prisoners live a whole lot better than we lived.
Well, that's true. I can sort of relate to that after doing some tent living of my own for a year.
Right.
And it's always an adventure to... they never show in the movies, you know, where these people wash up or go to the bathroom and stuff. And it's just as well that they don't.
No, that's right.
You have to become very creative sometimes.
Right.
While you're in England, in addition to the unfortunate story of this young woman, though, you ran into some American... women with the American Red Cross. And then I'd really like you to talk a little bit about that, if you could, because I found that part fascinating.
Well, I was halfway through my missions, and at that time they give you rest and recuperation. We call it flak leave. So I went into London, and as a matter of fact, when I got on the train at Bedford, England, which is about 50 miles from London, I was just worn out from all the flying and the excitement we'd gone through. And I was with one of my waist gunners, and I sat down and I never even looked across the we were in the compartment, you know, and I never looked to see who the other person was. And my friend started a conversation, and he kept talking to her, and I couldn't sleep, so I woke up and I looked, and this girl was absolutely gorgeous, just beautiful, and so I was taken by her, and so on the way down, I started talking to her, and we got to London. We shared a cab. It was raining, and I invited her and, of course, my friend to go to dinner, and she said, okay, and we had dinner together, and then one thing led to the other, and we really hit it off. We were in love with each other, and the war caused us to go over many bumps along the way, and it just never materialized for one reason or another, which is covered step by step in the book.
It is. And the other person with you in the compartment, was that your friend Mel?
No.
Oh, okay.
Mel was my very dearest friend, and he was shot down on his 17th mission, I believe it was. He was killed.
Right, yeah.
And that tore me apart, too. And by the way, I have to mention this, Dale. When I came back after that 1 week of leave, I went back to my barracks late Sunday afternoon. I'll never forget it. Walked in. And when I left, there were 38 of us in that barracks. When I walked back through the door, Jim, my buddy, was there. Jim said, Jack, you're not going to believe it, but you and I are the only two left. All the rest of them went down, shot down where you're going.
I want to talk a little, you know, more about some of those missions as we go along. We're talking with Jack Hubbard here, and the author of Patriot's Will, Surviving the Depression and World War II Combat. And, you know, we have talked to what we call the flyboys here on Veterans Radio over the last 9 years, some of the pilots, turret gunners, and so on and so forth. And, you know, they've described what their missions were like. And a lot of those sounded to me a lot like suicide missions. I mean, if you could describe just a little bit about flying over Berlin, let's say, the first time you went over Berlin.
The first mission, I was on the actual second mission that the Air Force went on. First one was on the 6th of March, 1944, and I went on the 8th. And flying over Berlin, the flak, the anti-aircraft firing away the missiles, exploding in the air at our altitude, you could get out and walk on the smoke. It was just unbelievable. And we lost 78 B-17s over Berlin, over the target, and then I think it was 49 or 48 on the way home. And it was just horrendous, and it was off of the flak. I couldn't stand the flak. That was just difficult. Fighters, that's another story. I didn't mind that all that much. I was scared all the time about all of it, like everyone else was, but I just really didn't like the flak.
I don't think I would like it either.
By the way, I have to mention this.
Yes.
We were required at the time to do 25 missions, okay? And I didn't learn until long after the war that if you got through 8, that was as many as the 8th Air Force really allocated that you'd really make.
Oh,
and when
so
I think back, 8, and you had to fly 25, you can see how difficult it was.
The odds really started going against you.
Yeah.
I can understand that. We didn't have a mission count or an hour count or anything like that, but as we got what we considered short, we got, you know, you get more and more nervous as you go and so forth.
In my book, I talk in detail about some of the really hairy missions, as I call them, difficult ones, and others I just kind of, you know, gloss over. But I cover all of them that I flew in the book.
I think it's interesting, as I mentioned to our audience, we're talking with Jack Hubbard, whose book is Patriot's Will. And you can get in on the conversation, if you'd like, by giving us a call here on Veterans Radio at 877-573-7825. That's 877-573-7825. The book has got some great pictures in here, and you know, and it's always fun to look at these pictures of us when we were much younger. You know, now we're, in your case, you're probably a 20-year-old stuck in a 90-year-old body. And it's, you know, it's how could I have ever done these things? Don't you ever wonder about that?
Well, what was that now?
I was just wondering, you know, when you look back on your adventures that you had during World War II, I know in my own experience, I look back and go, did I really do these things?
I couldn't believe I did it. Seriously, I mean, it's amazing to me, and I think back, boy, oh boy, I must have been out of my mind. But, you know, Dale, actually, when we were flying our missions, we never talked about death or the consequences or anything like that. We were young. All the crews were between 18 and 23 or 24 years old. We were trained to do our job, and when we were over enemy territory, we were too busy to even think about it.
Right, yeah. No, I can relate to that. You had some hair-raising adventures on some of these bombing missions that you went on. And I want to, just briefly for our audience, there's at the beginning of the book, you talk about one of your bombing runs over Berlin. And I'm just going to read just a portion of this.
Okay.
And try not to keep breathing while I'm doing this. And anyway, early morning, 8 May 1944, I left the briefing room shaking my head in disbelief. We were scheduled to fly another mission from our base in England to Berlin. I was feeling a little gun-shy at the prospects. This would be my fifth time over the heavily defended Nazi capital, a dangerous place to be at any time with over 1,600 anti-aircraft guns firing away at the Allied intruders. Our group took off with 30 bombers. The problems of flying in poor weather were never better illustrated throughout the history of the 306th Bomb Group than on this day. Five aircraft soon aborted the mission when they were unable to maintain formation while climbing to their briefed altitude. A newcomer to the group, a Lieutenant Darvin Smith, one of these five, dropped behind at 9:59 a.m. but later rejoined the formation. He then dropped back another time and was never seen again. It was later learned that the entire crew had been killed. How many crewmen are on a B-17?
Ten.
Ten. So ten people.
Mm-hmm.
At 10:42, about 1/2 hour before reaching Berlin, the single worst tragedy of loss in the 306 aircraft, not due to enemy action, occurred. Folks, if you're listening to it, just close your eyes and visualize what's happening here. Persistent contrails or vapor trails that we all see in the sky when, you know, airplanes are flying along made visibility difficult even though it was a bright sunny day at this cold and crisp altitude. Lieutenant Richard Lambert, 369th Bomb Squadron, was apparently caught in prop wash from an aircraft in front of them, quickly causing his aircraft to drop on top of another B-17. A rapid sequence of shocking events followed. Lambert's left wing panel flew off, and his aircraft seemed to make a loop around the fuselage of the plane piloted by a Lieutenant Edwin Jacobs, 367th Bomb Squadron, completely knocking off the tail section, which separated and plummeted into the wing of a third plane flown by Lieutenant Edwin Schlecht of the 369th. We watched in horror as all three aircraft in smoke and flames fell helplessly to their doom. Miraculously, four of the 30 crew members aboard the three aircraft survived this awful mid-air collision. I can't imagine watching that.
Well, we just happened to see it going on, you know, when it happened, and it was just really a tragedy. I just couldn't get over that.
I that would be one that would keep me up at night.
Yeah, I get tears in my eyes just when you read that, you know. It was just an awful situation.
Well, it gets worse.
Yeah.
We're not done yet, folks. This is just this is just one mission.
Right.
So anyway, so he goes over and you drop your bombs and you have to say, you know, bombs away. And as bombs away and they turn away to go home, you look inside the bomb bay and you notice that there's one bomb that didn't drop. And somehow it ends up being your duty to kick it out of the, kick it, folks. He's going to kick this 500-pound bomb out of an airplane. Presumably, I was expected to depend upon Yankee ingenuity, of course, because they didn't have a fallback system, it sounds like. Leaving the target as soon as possible, my pilot started evasive action, attempting to avoid the horrendous amount of flak exploding around us. I had to act quickly. I grabbed a portable oxygen bottle, because the aircraft was not pressurized, folks, like your normal airliner. He's at 20,000 feet, I should point out. Holding on to the metal vertical struts, he inched his way along a narrow catwalk not much wider than his boot. The ground over 20,000 feet below was visible through the open bomb bay doors. I don't know about any of you. If you have fear of heights, imagine looking straight down 20,000 feet. There was nothing but space on both sides of me. Fortunately, I had only time for a quick look at the ground below. The bitter cold wind and the temperatures at 20,000 feet are what, Jack? Approximately, do you remember?
It could be somewhere around 65 below zero.
Okay, we're going to have to stretch out. I'm going to have to stop this for a second because we're coming up on a break at the bottom of the hour. And we're going to come back and finish this segment about this adventure over Berlin. We're talking with Jack Hubbard, author of Patriot's Will, Surviving the Depression in World War II. You're listening to Veterans Radio. We'll be right back.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. It was Staff Sergeant Henry Irwin's job on the lead B-29 to drop a phosphorus canister as a marker when they reached the assembly area over enemy territory. Details after this.
It's not easy being a veteran.
Coming back from Iraq or Afghanistan, I had been so excited to come home.
But it's harder than I thought.
Not everyone understands that.
Join us at communityofveterans.org.
Because no one knows what it's like to come back unless they were there.
Brought to you by Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Irwin positioned the canister in the launch tube and pulled the pin at the pilot's orders. The flare dropped and then flew back into the plane. It exploded in Irwin's face, spewing flames just feet away from tons of incendiary bombs. Smoke filled the aircraft momentarily, blinding the pilot and co-pilot, and putting the plane in a steep dive. Irwin dropped to his knees and, unable to see, felt for the canister. Although it was burning at 1,300 degrees, he picked it up, cradled it to his body, and began crawling to the cockpit. He yelled to the co-pilot to open the window and threw the flare out. The crew then turned its fire extinguisher on him and began to feed plasma into his arm. Doctors were sure he was going to die and transferred him to Guam. Major General Curtis LeMay recommended him for the Medal of Honor and got authorities to expedite the award so it could be presented before he died. 1 week after the attack, LeMay presented the medal to Irwin at a bedside ceremony attended by the rest of his crew and his brother. Irwin surprised doctors by surviving. He was flown home to Alabama, where he was hospitalized for 2.5 years and underwent numerous operations. Henry Irwin died on January 16, 2002. The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
Goodbye, dear. I'll be back in a year, 'cause I'm in the Army now.
And back in a year, right. That's Horace Height and his musical nights, Jack. We're talking with Jack Hubbard, of author of Patriot's Will, here on Veterans Radio. And I tried to pick out songs that I don't know if you guys would recognize those or not. But we keep trying. Anyway, I was reading, before we took a break, I was reading a section from the book about one of Jack's missions over Berlin. And as they're leaving, he discovers that there's a bomb that has not been dropped. And so I want to continue where I was just here in a second. Okay. Fortunately, he's at 20,000 feet looking through the bomb bay doors. There's nothing but space on both sides of me. The bitter cold wind whipped through the bomb bay as their swerving, gyrating, unsteady plane continued along its way, unsure of its destiny. The sound of flak shells exploding close by was ear-splitting. Steel shrapnel burst in various sized pieces, flying in every direction. Some hit our own aircraft. It sounded like heavy drops of rain on a tin roof in a bad thunderstorm. They belched huge puffs of black smoke so thick it looked as though you could easily just walk on top of them. This was not conducive to my balancing act in the bomb bay catwalk, because time was of the essence. Reaching the bomb, I gave it a hard kick. He kicks a bomb, folks. Nothing happened. It didn't budge with the next kick either. Ice was forming rapidly on my oxygen mask. I was miserably cold and could feel my strength waning. It was now or never. Mustering my strength for what could be my last effort, I began kicking furiously. Finally, the bomb dropped, probably on some poor farmer's field. I scampered home back to the radio room and announced on the intercom, "Bomb bay all clear." After stowing the oxygen bottle, I returned to my seat, resting a few minutes to get my breath and warm up. I glanced at the top of my radio receiver in front of me, and my eyes settled on my parachute. In my haste to get to the bomb, I had forgotten to put it on. Indescribable feelings washed over me, including that of pure terror. I'm sorry to laugh here. I would have perished if I'd fallen through the bomb bay. What were you thinking?
I wasn't thinking.
Obviously. Obviously.
All I thought about was getting rid of that bomb.
But kicking a bomb. You know, people can never really understand this, and that's what I'm hoping our audience can kind of interpret as they're listening to people like Jack telling their story here on Veterans Radio about, you know, trying to kick a bomb. And this probably wasn't the first time that this occurred, and I'm sure that there are other crewmen on B-17s, 24s, 29s, all those various planes that can say, oh, yeah, I did that.
You know, they did, right.
You know,
From time to time.
I mean, I can remember our door gunners, you know, leaning out on the skids trying to fix their, you know, they had melted the barrel and they're trying to change the barrel on their M60 machine guns. And you're going, what were you thinking? You know, they didn't even have a wire to them. They just leaned out to fix these things. that's what we do. And that's what you state in the book, and I would encourage our people to go out and find this book. It's a great story. So we're bombing Berlin, and your whole thing is that you're supposed to do these 25 missions. And,
yes.
Can you talk about some of the other ones? Because not only did you bomb things, but you also threw out pamphlets.
Yes. Mm-hmm. It was propaganda. Pamphlets, you know, about the war. And it was in the thousands we dumped, you know, over a city.
Mm-hmm. Were those things designed to just say, hey, listen, you know, if you guys don't give up, we're going to keep doing this?
I don't remember the details, to be honest with you, Dale. It had to do with their leadership and, you know, how it was hopeless to continue the war and that sort of thing.
When some of your other missions, and you were there at the time of the D-Day invasion, and you were you mentioned this in your book that when Eisenhower took over, can you talk about the sense and the feeling that you had as a military person there getting ready to invade Europe?
Well, we had longed for that to happen, you know, because. It was necessary if we're going to win the war. That's all there was to it. But after Dieppe, that's when the Canadians lost. Practically every man that was sent over there, about 10,000 went, and I think they lost about 7,000 or 8,000 at Dieppe. But that was to check out the coast to see how strong the defenses were by the Germans. But when you think about that, and then what we were undertaking with the invasion of Normandy, you know, that was just unbelievable, the whole thing. And what was the question? I forgot.
That's all right. No, the question was, I just wanted to know what you felt like. Were you flying that particular day? Were you able to observe it?
Well, that was, I'll never forget that either. I think everyone was up at midnight to prepare for that mission, and word got around real quick that that's what it was, the invasion. And so everybody went out, you know, to try to get on the mission, because we knew it would be what we called a milk run. There'd be little or no opposition from the German flyers. It was just over the coast and back again. And I wanted to get on that to get credit for a combat mission. So I was unable to do so, even though my group flew three missions that during that period. And but of course I did later on. I think it was the sixth day and maybe the eighth day afterwards. I flew.
I think it was amazing. I want you to kind of, if you could, describe an ordinary day, if there were ordinary days of missions, of what time that you would get up and how you were fed and stuff. And I'm going to go into this story because I love the ending of it. But when did you normally would you get up for these missions?
Well, 2:30 or 3 or 3:30 in the morning, and of course we had to clean up, and then from there we went to the mess hall for breakfast, and usually it was unappetizing. I remember we had the powdered eggs floating like in water, and it was just a poor breakfast. And then from there we had to go to the the supply room to get all of our equipment and flying clothes and all that sort of thing. And then we had briefing combat briefing about that particular mission.
Could you describe a little bit about those briefings with the big map on the wall, and they would disclose where you were going?
Yeah, they had the map of that part of Europe that we were involved in, France and Germany and so forth. And they had a red piece of yarn from our base in England to the target, and then the return to our base from the target. And then en route, they identified where heavy flak was to be expected in fighters, and then various people briefed us on the mission. The intelligence people briefed us, and the weather people, and that sort of thing. And it was quite thorough. And I remember it so well that the first time the mission going to Berlin, people gasped, and you know, they had comments, and some of them weren't too good. But anyway, we knew that once we started to Berlin, that was going to be very difficult because it was the most heavily defended place on Earth at that time.
Yeah, you mentioned in your book the idea of that when you went in for that briefing, that part of the map was covered up. And like a little, you know, an extension of the map was added to it, but it was covered.
Right.
And everybody was getting a little nervous, and then they unveiled it, and there's this, you know, red line going to Berlin, and you're just going, uh-oh, here we go. All right, so let's suppose that you were flying to Berlin. How long would it take you to get to Berlin and back again in most cases?
In those cases, I think it was around 8 hours, 8 and a half or something. In the back of the book, I list all my missions and where to and how long it took and all that sort of thing. And I think the ones to Berlin, I'm looking at the book right now. I just happen to have a copy here.
Just happen to have one.
9 hours and 20 minutes, 9 hours and 30. One time, 8:35, I guess that was due to the weather and so forth and so on. 9 hours. So, say 9 hour round trip.
That's a long. And then what? And when you got home safely, what kind of food did you get then?
Well, after we had steaks with eggs and whatever you wanted. It was just incredible. And I usually had 6 fried eggs on top of a steak. And
and you're 90 years old. How did you do that? I bet your doctor wouldn't let you do that now, right?
No, I eat about 1 a year is what I have.
That's amazing. And you, in the book, the line that makes me chuckle is that you talk about they didn't want to waste the good food because some people might not be coming back.
That's right.
dark humor was...
They'd have less eggs to put out when you return than you did when you started out.
I can understand that. All right, let's talk about now that you're coming up on your last mission, and you know you're getting ready to and you somehow got sent home one mission early, or no? They counted an extra one for you, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. What happened? They changed it from when I had the 17th or 18th mission in, they changed it from 25 to 30 because we were winning the war against the German Air Force. And so they prorated the number of missions that people had. In my case, I had, I think, 27 or something like that. I don't remember exactly.
But, all right, guess what? You get to go home.
I got to go home, yes.
And talk about that. The sensation of doing that?
Well, you know, I was in England for 3 years, kind of my Canadian time. And to go home to see my mother and my brother in Chattanooga, Tennessee, it was just, it was most exciting. I just couldn't believe it. Because I'd written quite a few letters to my mother, and luckily they were all saved, and I included 12 of them in my book to get the flavor of the times, you know, and they were unedited, so, you know, anyway. I don't think I can put in words how exciting it was to get home finally.
Well,
in one piece, of course, you can imagine how my mother felt.
Yeah, I can imagine that, because we've talked about this on the program. We're coming up on a break, so we're just going to kind of stretch here a little bit about, you know, it's our parents and our girlfriends and our wives and so forth that are at home that that didn't know what happened to us or where we were, and sometimes mail wouldn't necessarily get through. And I noticed that some of your letters you're talking about, you know, I didn't hear from you, and what's happening here. And so we're going to talk about that when we come back. We're talking with Jack Hubbard here on Veterans Radio. It's a great story. So come on back in just a moment. You're listening to Veterans Radio. We'll be right back.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
Some people say he's just a crazy guy. To me, he means a million other things. For he's the one who taught this happy heart of mine to fly. He wears a pair of silver wings.
And that is Dinah Shore. We're digging deep here for finding this music. Dinah Shore was, he wears a, where did she go? He wears a pair of silver wings. We're talking with Jack Hubbard here, who's the author of A Patriot's Will and about his adventures during World War II and the Depression. And it's kind of a great little history lesson here. And I was going to play Chattanooga Choo Choo, but it was Carmen Miranda and she was singing in Portuguese or something. So we decided not to use that one.
Okay.
We've got a caller on the line for you. It's Doug Mann from Milan, Michigan. Would like to ask you a question. Just a second. Doug, go ahead.
Yeah, T. Berry, this is Doug Mann. Mr. Hubbard, I would just like to thank you for your service to our country, the sacrifices you and your families have made during that era are responsible for the life that we live in America today, as we have previously served under the American flag, and you guys have just made that even more important by listening to your story. It's a wonderful story, sir, and thank you very much.
Well, that was very kind of you. I really appreciate that.
Well, that's. I think I'm going to have a lot of listeners commenting on that, and thank you very much, Doug.
No, it's not. It's Dog Man, T-Berry.
Oh, Dog. Oh, Nina. Doug Man, not Dog Man.
That's all right.
Thank you, Vance.
All right, buddy. Later. Bye.
Okay.
That was nice of him to call in and say that.
It was. Vance is our one of our technical experts who, is, in fact, he is the one that's going to archive the program later on our website. So if you didn't get a chance to listen to all of the interview, you're going to be able to this afternoon at veteransradio.net. Click on archives, and it'll be right there. And Jack, he's the one that will be sending you a copy of the program.
Oh, okay. Wonderful.
So I wanted to ask you a question about why you wrote this book, and I wanted to thank your daughter Sherry for you know inspiring you to do this. What did you hope to accomplish with this?
Well, first of all, I had no idea of writing a book. My daughter wanted me to put down my experiences of flying in World War II, and so I started putting that down, and one thing led to another, added some more. And I'd written about 40 pages. My brother-in-law, a teacher, read it, and he said, you ought to write a book. So that's how it came about.
Well, we had talked earlier in the week, and I want to make sure that people can get a copy of this if they can. So you mentioned that you would love to send them an autographed copy of the book. And
yes.
How would we go about getting that information to you?
Well, either call me at area code 239 433-1210 or J. Hubbard, H-U-B-B-A-R-D, 121 at gmail.com. And the book is $20 and $3 for shipping and handling, so it's a total of of $23.
$23 for an autographed book by a genuine American hero. And I know that we never admit that, you know, that, that maybe we did do something that other people didn't do. But I think it's important, and you mentioned this in the book, too, that it's so important for us to acknowledge our veterans.
Well, the ones that I really feel sorry for are the Vietnam veterans. I got such a raw deal. My heart really goes out to them. It really does. It just, the more I think about it, it's a tragedy what happened to them. You know, the reception back in America after all they went through.
I couldn't agree with you more on that. And we're going to be doing a couple of programs, obviously, on Vietnam War veterans and looking at that war from the perspective of the veteran. And also, you mentioned in your book, and I've read this, in fact, for next week's, I've read something already about this, you know, that the media didn't do a very good job. And, of course, our politicians, you know, just kind of put their tail between their legs and went home. Unfortunately, they didn't tell us about that.
Dale,
yes.
I was going to mention something. Those timelines were put in there mainly for the young people to keep abreast of where they were, you know, during the war. But the best picture they ever made, in my opinion, was the picture called 12 O'Clock High with Gregory Peck.
Right.
That is truly the way it was. And not only that, it was about my bomb group, the 306. And the picture in the book, they called it the 908. They just tripled the 306 and called it 908.
That is true, and you did mention that in there, and it is one of my favorite movies, and now I'm going to have to go watch it again to show people really what life was like at the time. And it's not, you know, we always kind of look at war and veterans and so forth, and people, you know, tend to glorify what we had to go through. But I think if they read your story, they're going to see that it's not a glorious thing to do.
No, not at all.
And, you know, and I've mentioned this many, many times. There is no organization out there called Veterans for War. We want to do everything we can to make sure that we don't have to go through these things again, ever.
Well, you know, we lost over 14,000 aircraft during the war from the 8th Air Force, and we lost more men killed than all the Marines in World War II.
People
don't realize what the casualties were.
Well, I was surprised. I mean, I was surprised when you mentioned earlier that a crew of 10, and every time one of those airplanes would crash, in most cases, all 10 of them would perish. And that's very sad.
Well, not only did they have B-17s, but we also had the B-24 aircraft.
And they were slower, right?
No, they're a little bit faster.
Oh, see, that's why I need my partner Bob here today. He's the one that knows all about World War II aircraft.
They were just a little bit faster.
But it was really difficult. You know, we always talk about, you know, the B-17s and 24s and 29s and so forth, but also it has to do with the support aircraft that you had that would protect you going in and out.
Oh, yes, particularly the T-51 fighter.
Mm-hmm.
We had T-38s, T-47s and the 51. But when the 51 was developed with gas tanks, they could go all the way into Berlin and back.
Yeah, I think that would be a great advantage because, I mean, you were involved in so many missions. There's some great pictures in his book. It's Jack Hubbard, Patriot's Will, of, you know, B-17s, and I mentioned we've done programs about B-17s in the past, and, you know, sometimes I don't understand how these guys could land these planes when they're missing most of it. tails missing, wings missing, nose cones missing. It's just amazing to me that they were able to do this.
That was a tough aircraft.
They were tough, and we've got one here at the Yankee Air Force Museum here in Ypsilanti, Michigan, and they talk about, I mean, they have one that they give rides on, that they have refurbished, and Bob went on a ride with that, and he said it was just amazing.
And when you think it's only 3/16 of an inch aluminum, you know, surrounding you, that's not much.
No.
Particularly when the flak went through it.
I know. People don't realize that. You go up to these, you know, you figure they're going to be these armored, you know, airplanes, and nothing could get through them, and you push on it, it goes in and out like it's aluminum foil. Because, you know, it had to be light to get off the ground with everything else that went along with it.
That's right.
Wow. I'm just amazed at this story, Jack, and I'm hoping that people will contact you, because it's unfortunately your generation is passing along rather rapidly, and we've got to make sure we get these stories out.
Well, they're dying off the rate of about 1,500 a day, so.
I know, and unfortunately, Vietnam veterans are not that far behind. I think somebody mentioned the other day it was around 700 a day, and you know, we got to get these stories out. And I know that you are have given talks to various service groups, probably in your area in Florida.
Mainly, I did cruise ships. I spoke on 12 different cruise ships.
Oh, that's a tough gig.
That was tough, is right.
I got to figure out how you get to do that one. That's great.
That was great. And my wife could go with me, which made it all that much nicer.
Tell me a little bit about your family. You mentioned your wife in the book. And
well, I have a wife, first marriage, a daughter, I'm sorry, but mm-hmm. first marriage. And second marriage, I have three boys.
Any of them in the service?
None of them, but one of them was ROTC Army lieutenant, and he was just on active duty with the National Guard. Later, that was about it.
We got about 2 minutes left, and Nina wanted to ask this question earlier, and so I'll do it for her. But you were initially rejected by the United States Army because of flat feet. Is that
yes? True? I was.
How can flat feet affect what you do? Is it supposedly you can't run
the Army? I don't know. I tried the Navy too, and the same thing. And that's when I decided to go to Canada.
You know, considering how many people they needed at the time, you know, oh, I'm sorry, you got flat feet, you can't go. You know, I can put arches in my shoes.
Right.
if that's the problem.
When I transferred to the American forces from the Canadian, the Americans never even paid any attention to it.
How long did it take you to do that transfer? In the book you mentioned that it took quite a while for you to
transfer. It took a long time to get the paperwork all through, yeah. Several months.
Wow. Well, Jack Hubbard, it's such a pleasure to talk to you on Veterans Radio, and I want to thank you for being on the program. I want to encourage people to contact Jack to get a copy of his book, Patriot's Will, and we'll put his phone number and his email address up there on our website. When you go into the archives, we'll have both of them there available so that you can get a hold of a copy of this book for yourself. And Jack, thank your daughter for pushing you to do this. And thank your whole family and all the friends. I greatly appreciate the book. Thank you so much.
Well, I greatly appreciate you having me on your program. Thank you so much, and God bless you.
God bless you too, Jack.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's Jack Hubbard, the author of Patriot's Will, Serving the Great Depression and World War II Combat. Just an amazing story about a young man who just survived the Depression, survived World War II, and went on to a very successful life. So I encourage you to contact him if you can to get your own autographed copy of his book. Coming up next week on Veterans Radio, we're going to be talking to a young woman. Now we're talking about a daughter's journey. And the book is called Dr. Tom's War, A Daughter's Journey. It's about Dr. Tom Vitti and his experiences in Vietnam. And she put this book together for her sake and to find out a little bit more about her dad. And I can certainly relate to that. So I'm excited to have Lucia on the program next week. And that's going to be it for today. Today's technical director was Nina. And I was the one who produced the program. So until next week, you are dismissed.
All views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily of Veterans Radio or this station. Veterans Radio is a production of Veterans Radio, LLC.